Blog Talk Radio.
There's some dangerous large carnivore out there.
Yeah, I saw that bird get the young deer off the road and fly away.
And it was just about getting dark, and we started panicking, running down the ridge, not really having any clue what was throwing rocks in our vicinity, good-sized rocks. And I stopped long enough to get a 357 out of my backpack and looked back, and that's when I saw it. I saw one.
For a week, the town of Defiance was being harassed by a werewolf. And it's actually attacked two railroad workers, killed livestock. You know, just a lot of weird stuff that was going on.
Welcome to Monster X Radio, where X marks the spot for everything cryptid. It's Sunday, July 27th, 2014. I'm your host, Johnny Bigfoot. With me tonight are my co-hosts, Sasquatch Coffee founder, Gunnar Monson, and Bigfoot enthusiast, Crystal. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing great, John.
How are you?
Great. And for those of you in the chat room, we will be drawing for a 5-variety sample pack of the delicious Sasquatch coffee. And that will happen after the break. So stay with us, and then at the beginning of the second hour, we'll do that drawing. Well,
why don't we start off on tonight.
Yeah, DW. There are a lot of good things about him. He's been around the community a long time. I'm not as familiar with them, so it'll be a learning experience for me as well. Why don't we start off and talk some Bigfoot news, and then we'll get to our guest. So, Gunnar, you just got back from the big event, Beachfoot. How was it?
I did. It was a blast, man. There's about 100 people there, so Todd Neese puts on that event every year. I got to see my first Bigfoot wedding, Todd and his longtime companion, Diane Stocking, got married. Professor Rettman Mullis married them. It was totally a surprise, so that was fun. Oh, yeah, I mean, we had Bob Gimlin there. We had, you know, Tom Yamarone, who teaches what's in the movie, Bobcat Goldthwait's movie, Willow Creek. He does a lot of Bigfoot songs, so he was singing around the campfire. Dr. John Bindernagel was there, and of course Rettman Mullis of Bigfootology was there, so a lot of good programs. Paul Graves, who's in the Olympic Project, was there. Derek Randall with the Olympic Project was there, so got to sit around and get updated and All my team from Tillamook Forest Research Group was there, so we hooked up with Bigfootology and we're working to work closer with the Olympic guys from the Olympic Project and gal from the Olympic Project. So it was a great time.
Nice. Was that the whole weekend then?
Yeah, it started actually. People started arriving on Thursday, so we took off about noon on Sunday, so. I actually wasn't on the show last last week because a couple of members of my team, we went up and had an audio encounter that a guy that was out camping had had, so we went out to the area to check it out.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. He's been doing this for a number of years then, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been... I had been in the BFRO as an investigator for, probably 15 years. So I just...
I mean, the Beachfoot thing?
Beachfoot? Yeah, I think the first year I went was 2011. I think this was Todd's 7th year of doing it. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was very...
Is that in Oregon?
It was, yeah, down just
okay.
Outside of... south at Waldport. So.
Nice.
Yeah, it was great. Todd does a great... They did a great job. We actually had a... Les Stroud actually Skyped into the event and did a presentation, so... That was fun.
Oh, I had seen something about that on Facebook.
Yeah, he's getting it, he's back on, you know, getting ready to do his new season, so it should be exciting. He did it, you know, he did a couple episodes of with Todd Standing.
And so there won't be any more Survivor Man Bigfoot episodes, or
I think there's something in the works. So.
Oh, okay.
Cool. And there is also another new show coming out from the people that brought us Mountain Monsters. It's called Monsters Underground.
Looks interesting. The trailer looks interesting. But I think the clue is in it that it's coming from the people that brought us Mountain Monsters.
I had not watched Mountain Monsters, unfortunately.
No, Crystal, I don't think it's a very scripted show. I mean, of course, we can say the same thing about Finding Bigfoot, but...
Finding Bigfoot, most reality shows now, I find, are pretty well scripted.
Right, yeah.
Bill Brock's going to be heading the team.
I'll give it a shot, see how it goes. I mean, I watched Bigfoot Bounty, and just because of the entertainment value, but it did not do anything to further Bigfoot. Oh, you know who I forgot to mention? Richter was at Beachfoot. Nah, I had never met Richter before, so Richter is a character.
Nice. The show looks entertaining.
Yeah, it does, so we'll see.
A lot of people are into that Mountain Monsters, so you never know. This could be successful, too.
So this
premieres
is...
August 22nd at 10, 9 Central in Destination America.
And the premise this time is caves as opposed to mountains or wilderness. I'm sure they're within a wooded setting to find the caves. But
so there's dangerous caves.
Yeah.
So it should be some more entertainment.
Like kind of like the series CSI now. They're spinning off, Mountain Monsters, and now we're in the mountains, now we're in caves. Pretty soon, where else will we go?
Flatland. They're obviously catering to the general public, like Finding Bigfoot. So the serious researcher is probably going to be upset at things which might not appear to look normal or... hoaxy.
Yeah. Well, I always laugh when people, get on Finding Bigfoot because this is reality TV is a misnomer. You know, it's scripted reality TV.
Yeah.
So don't put too much credence in what you're seeing. So there's some, Cliff Berrickman's a real Bigfoot researcher. The guy is hardcore and he goes out, when he's not on TV. He's out actually doing Bigfooting. He's nuts. He goes out he does things that other people don't have the guts to go out and do it. He'll go out and walk around in the pitch black. Doesn't sleep in the tent. I mean, if you ask him if he's concerned about getting ball beat, I think he has a fantasy about going by being torn apart by a squad.
Oh, good Lord. Or something else. I mean,
he doesn't carry a gun. You know, he is one with nature. So.
Nice. And did you hear about the Houston Bigfoot Hunter? Who's offering college-style classes on Bigfoot.
I did see something about that. It looks interesting, but a friend of mine just bought a Groupon to send his granddaughter to Bigfoot camp for a weekend, where they're going to take him out in the woods and
He
and her dad are going out to look for Bigfoot with, some people are taking the entrepreneurial spirit and adding Bigfoot to it.
Well, it's good to get outside.
Right. Yeah, it's not bad for me. Not bad for the kids to get out, do something besides play Xbox.
So for just $75, you can have the chance to learn from an experienced Bigfooter about the subject of Bigfoot. It's taken place in Houston. Apparently this guy has spent his whole life investigating, and now he's offering this class. His name is Rob Riggs. Sounds familiar. You know, he spent a lot of time in the Big Thicket area east of Houston, and his classes are this fall, I think September 13th.
Houston seems like a mecca for Bigfoot research.
Well, it's east of there. The Big Thicket covers, I think, parts of Oklahoma as well. It's a hot spot there in Texas and Oklahoma.
Yeah, Oklahoma does have some crazy Bigfoot activity. It seems like they're in eastern Oklahoma.
Yeah. And that's where our guest is from tonight. And I guess on that note, we'll introduce him. Our guest for the evening is a Bigfoot researcher from Oklahoma. He's the founder of the MABRC, which stands for the Mid-America Bigfoot Research Center. He also has a new book in the works on how to Bigfoot research. He's had a number of Bigfoot encounters over the years, and few people have spent as much time in the field as he has. Welcome, Darren Lee, to the show. How you doing, Darren?
Thanks, everybody. Oh, pretty good. How about y'all?
Great.
Thank you.
Oklahoma.
Matter of fact, just to let y'all know, I just actually come in from the woods, so, you know, I do spend a lot of time out there.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, it seems to be a hot spot out there in eastern Oklahoma. Is that where you go?
Yeah, we actually have quite a few research areas that are basically all connected to each other by a high-voltage power line right of way. And one of my researchers was out in one of our areas last night and actually had a large figure step out in front of him while he was sitting there beside his campfire. So
very cool. I was out in our research area Friday night. I was out in our research area Friday night. It was pretty quiet, but always fun to get out.
I just started watching The Town That Bigfoot Built. I'm sure you've heard of that. You might even be in that.
Yeah, matter of fact, we was down there when they were filming it and even had one of our MABRC members, driver-operator, speaking in it.
Okay, that's... How do you pronounce that? Honobia, Oklahoma?
Honobi.
Okay. And I did post that on my blog, so if people want to check out that, it's pretty good. I've watched most of it so far. And for all the news stories that we discussed earlier and more, check out Bigfoot Research News blog. Yeah, it's cool. It's a town that Bigfoot built, so it seems like, you know, that documentary really... showed a lot about the local interest there and how it created the Bigfoot Festival, which goes on every year, and you're a part of that as well, huh?
What, the Hunnaby?
Yeah.
Well, we put on the conference for the first 3 years back in 2007, 2008, and 2009, and then we kind of moved on, and now we've got our own Oklahoma Bigfoot Symposium the first weekend of October. And it's in Stillwell, Oklahoma, if anybody wants to venture down and check it out.
Oh, okay. So you guys have branched off and have your own now.
Yeah. So.
So you're the founder of the MARBC, huh?
Yeah. We actually started out as a Green Country Bigfoot Research Center back in 98, and we had such a big increase in membership that we had to eventually call ourselves the Mid-America Bigfoot Research Center. And, of course, now there's some debate whether or not we need to rename ourselves the North American Bigfoot Research Center, because we've got researchers across the country and even in New Zealand and Australia. And so, you know, we're pretty much an international group now.
Okay. So what got you into Bigfoot? How did you get started?
Well, back in 1977, here in my hometown, we actually had basically a hoax go on. But at the time, you know, everybody thought it was the real deal. And that kind of piqued my interest. And then about 15 years later, I actually got to watch, Legend of Boggy Creek, like everybody, you know, likes to refer back to as the what got them started. But it just got my curiosity aroused, so I went on down here to Folk, Arkansas, and kind of looked around and checked things out. And pretty much after that, I just started getting more and more involved in it. And then there was a bunch of encounters that happened around my hometown, and we started checking those out, and then the next thing you know, we're pretty much doing it on a full-time basis.
Wow. It's, you know, like I've said before, and others have said, growing up, to me, Bigfoot was always just in the Pacific Northwest. It was a distant thing until I started seeing these TV shows that popped up, but it seems like Oklahoma gets its fair share of action.
Actually, to be honest with you, Oklahoma has probably got the most activity right now in the country, because just a lot of us not making the major report databases. So we have activity. We have more activity probably than Washington does.
Oh, wow. Interesting. What's the topography and landscape like there?
Well, the great thing about Oklahoma is we've got four or five different terrain sets. Here in the eastern side of the state, we pretty much have mountains and hills, and it's real heavy vegetation and rolling hills and ravines, stuff like that. And then as you go out towards the west, it turns into more flat out land and, you know, prairie grass, stuff like that. But we've got researchers out in the west part of the state that they found just as much evidence out there as we have here in the eastern part of the state.
Really?
Yeah.
But the BFRO is going to show mostly the eastern part of the state, huh?
Well, I've actually got quite a few friends that are BFRO researchers that does help research in the northeast part of Oklahoma, but there's not really that many BFRO members in Oklahoma that really reports all the activity that we have.
Okay. Interesting. So you've got,
and I know they just
FLIRs and everything, huh?
Yeah.
When you go out.
Oh yeah, we've got them mounted in all types of configurations. We've got them mounted on four-wheelers and Polaris Rangers. Then, of course, that's just going down trails at night. And then, of course, we've got them to where they're portable, and we can sit there in a basically a hide and watch everything around us. Or we even got them set up to where we put them up through the top of our tent on a pole and can spin them around and watch the entire camp while we're sitting inside the tent. That way, you know, they think we're sleeping and everything. So,
that's awesome. You think it's all about the nighttime then, huh? I mean, daytime, you know, obviously you can see better. I mean, what are these things doing during the daytime if they're so active at night? Are they just hiding out somewhere?
Well, we've actually had just as much activity in the daytime as we have at nighttime. You know, they don't go all night long, you know, hunting and stuff like that. They even hunt during the day. It's just they're more cautious during the daytime. And some of the things that will come out in this book that I'm writing talks about how the Bigfoot will move just as carefully at night as they do it during the day. And, you know, they like to stay away from view so much that you just have to be at the right place at the right time to be able to see one during the daytime.
Okay. When is your book coming out?
Well, I've been writing on it for most of a year now, and every time I write about one subject, two more subjects pop up that I need to write about, but I'm hoping to have it done by November at the latest. It's currently about 500 pages, and it discusses just about everything involved with Bigfoot research as far as, you know, it's not the ultimate guide, you know, I mean, not everything that works for me works for somebody else, but it gives you a better idea of what's been tried, you know, how you should try it for best results. Even talks about the photo analysis, you know. We've got a big problem right now of people posting pictures where they claim there's 20, 30 Bigfoot in each picture, and, you know. It kind of goes into detail how to weed that stuff out. So.
Oh, really? There's a method for doing that?
Well,
because
basically, basically the way I view it, unless it's really out in the open to where you can actually tell it's a Bigfoot, pretty much everything else is just, for lack of a better word, basically the pictures are just trash. I mean, if we're really going to prove this thing, you need to have one standing right out in the open to where it's hard to deny that there is a creature standing there. And it sure can't look like one of the costumes that they've got out there. So, and even then, you know, there's still going to be the people that says, oh, you know, that's just somebody in a suit. So.
Yeah, I think I remember you talking about something like that on Facebook, or you were saying back in the day no one would show anything unless it was somewhat legit and they would present it in a more objective manner, whereas today people will, like you say, throw up pictures and go with 30 circles and get pissed at you because you're not seeing them.
Yeah, because you're not the chosen to be able to view these Bigfoot, and it's like, you know what? When I started back, I was one of the first ones in the that hung out at the BFF when it was going strong. And I learned a lot from the old-timers that had been in Bigfooting for a lot longer than I had. And basically, it was, you said probable, you said possible. You never come out and said, oh, that is definitely a Bigfoot, because you know, you can't prove it. Really, you can't. So the best thing to do is just say, you know, this is a possible. And then nobody can actually get you for claiming it was a Bigfoot. So.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of people that do that very thing, though. Say, oh, this, and of course, a lot of times it's accompanied by red circles.
Yeah. Pretty much, and Tom Powell actually pointed this out to me a few years back when we spent time in the field with him. You know, if you have to draw a red circle on a picture, then the picture is invalid. I mean, if you can't see something there without having to draw a red circle on it, great. But if you have to draw a red circle, the picture is worthless, really.
Absolutely. I agree.
Why do you think it's gotten the way it has today?
Facebook.
Okay.
I mean,
instant gratification.
Yeah, you know, people get on Facebook and they start posting these pictures, and people that really don't know, you know, otherwise, will actually start patting these people on the back and giving them a big, what's the word I'm looking for? A big ego. And then these people just get worser and worser about what they put out there. And, you know, when the old-time researchers say, you know, there ain't nothing there, these people get belligerent, start calling people names. You know, you're not the chosen one if you can't see those pictures or see the Bigfoot in their pictures. And it's like, seriously? You know, sound like more like need to be doing some doing some really good drugs to be able to see the Bigfoot. So
we have to squint your eyes just the right way and stand on one foot.
Yeah.
So
camping. You know, but as far as I'm concerned, Facebook has been the biggest detriment to Bigfoot research because it allows allows everybody to have an audience. And some of those people really don't need an audience because they're not really producing anything. So, but that's my opinion, you know. I'll probably get slammed on it for a few days on Facebook afterwards.
How dare you?
Yeah.
I've experienced that too. It's like you can't question some of these people that put
haters.
Well, you put something up and you can't question. Like, I can't see what you're telling me is there. Well, it's because you're not, you know, the chosen one. You'll never see one because of your, like, no, I just want to see, I can't see what you're seeing. It looks like a black blob or a shadow to me. So, they get very defensive.
They do, and it's almost as if they're, because there is so little known, it seems throughout, these people are attempting to make up for it by offering the answers that others are looking for, and those people are willing to accept it as fact, and they are kind of pumping it up as some sort of, you know, there's the question of whether or not you believe in Bigfoot, but they're pumping it up into some sort of a belief system. Like you said, you're not a chosen one. You're not worthy. You're not as pure of heart as the rest of us. You're not open. You're never going to be able to understand, and that's actually a little bit weird, because, you know, coming into this, I'm under the impression that, you know, there's the possibility for a, you know, a creature, just a regular animal, if you will, and then all of a sudden you find that, yeah, I believe you because of Facebook. There are all these different aspects being pumped up around it just because there's so little available in the way of knowledge. So these, you know, I don't know who these people are or what they do for a living, but they very easily come in and they gain followings of, you know, thousands of people. And they're offering, I don't know a nice way to say it. You know what they're offering.
Yeah, big pile of crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one way of saying
it. It is.
Yeah.
It's being accepted.
Yeah, and you're right, DW. They get an audience. Now these people have people that look up to them, and, you know, they probably feel like they're a part of something. They feel special now, and, you know.
And imagine if it started out as, you know, a joke or something. And now these people have gained these followings, and they can't back out now. And then in the big picture of it, you know, there are people who are actually going out and working toward progressing toward overall, I guess, a proof of these creatures. They're looking toward a discovery. If that were to ever happen and they were to be discovered as a flesh and blood animal, what happens then to these groups of people who've been toyed with, and or the people who are spouting all of these odd, off-the-wall ideals?
I think what'll end up happening is most of these people will try to portray themselves as ultimate experts, you know, and because basically when Bigfoot is actually proven to be proven real to, you know, the general public, you're going to have everybody looking for people that know the answers, and of course, a lot of these people will be coming into the community, and they won't know who's who in the community. And they'll latch on to whoever shares the same ideas that they do, and they'll believe everything they say. And, of course, I'll probably end up causing a lot of eyebrows to be raised, but perfect person, you know, Matthew Johnson. He has literally built his own, for lack of a better way of saying it, a cult, because everything that he says, people seem to believe everything he says, and there's a lot of the old-time researchers that are stepping up and saying, you know, that really don't make sense what he's trying to claim. And, you know, people have latched onto him because he supposedly knows all about Bigfoot, and they listen to every word he says, and that's what's going to happen with the general public when Bigfoot is proven to exist. They're going to come in. They're not going to know really who's who in the Bigfoot community like a lot of us that's been in it for a long time. And they'll latch on to anybody that has any inkling of an idea that matches their own way of thinking. I hope that makes sense.
True. But if they're proven to be a flesh and blood creature, I think you'll be able to rule out some of these other views and beliefs, which might hurt some people.
Yeah. But overall, you know, it'll be where you'll still have, and this will probably catch a lot of grief, but you'll have the crazies that will attach themselves to the crazies. You know, it's
true.
Just like any religion, really, you know. You'll have the ones that really go to the extreme. So,
yeah, that's true. Speaking of flesh,
you,
and
go ahead. I mean, I know Dr. Johnson pretty well, and I actually have been to SOA, and I don't know about any of the other, some of the special attributes that he attributes to them. All I know is that we found fingerprints on a food bowl, so rest of it. I mean, there was some stuff that there's something going on down in SOA. I don't know anything about, you know, that they're trans-dimensional or I have had not, or that they can close or they mind speak. I just I know there's something going on around the food bowl. So, and I can tell you, he wasn't hoaxing when we were down there, and subsequently, I know Adam Davies has been down there and they have had more activity. It'll be interesting to see, because Adam actually recovered hair from food bowl area. So he had the smart idea to put double stick tape on the food bowls, and they got some hair. So I actually turned Matt was also telling me that he had saliva in his freezer, and had not, you know, I don't like how many people out there, because one of the things in Bigfooting that is a I think, a detriment. Is, you know, we're so fragmented, and I wonder how many people are sitting on evidence they don't know what to do with. But we actually had somebody that came to Beachfoot last year that said he was willing to process DNA evidence for DNA. So I hooked Matt up with him, and
like
I hope
said,
maybe something will come out of it. So I don't know. But
like you
but
said, it's fragmented.
Everyone,
and a lot of this is Facebook. You know, people have their own groups. They run them a certain way. They have their own beliefs, which upsets other people, or they don't believe that way. So, yeah, it's a very fragmented community.
And, you know, I can't say this about the MABRC. We don't have a set mindset about what Bigfoot is, and except for, it, you know, it's flesh and blood. But one of the main tenets of our organization is everybody has a right to their own opinion, and you know, it seems to work pretty good. We've got a lot of people. We've got 500 members, and you know, whenever you see a bunch of us get together, there's a lot of differences of opinion, but nobody tries to force it down everybody else's throat. So you know, like you said, Facebook has just enabled too many people to have their own little groupies, and you know, they form these little cliches, and you know, if you say something bad about somebody, then they're all over you. And so
yeah, definitely. And we got a little bit of static coming through. I wonder if it's someone has their speakers on or if there's anything we can do about it. I guess someone is having a trouble hearing somebody.
It may be on my end. I'm actually sitting in a computer room where I've got air conditioning going, so if it gets too bad, I'll have to...
Gotcha. Someone couldn't hear Gunner, but speaking of flesh and blood, you know, what I really want to know is I've heard through the grapevine that you had a really incredible sighting at one point. I know you've had a number of encounters where you and multiple people witnessed a Bigfoot for a little bit of time doing something. Is that correct?
Yeah. Basically, this is why I can't believe in the cloaking theory about Bigfoot. Me and one of my other researchers, he's a wrestling coach. And his wrestlers did a pretty good job for that year, so kind of as a little reward for all their hard work, we took them out Bigfooting, and we stayed the whole weekend out there. And just so happened the one of the nights we were going to put them all out in a listening post. So we extended them all out along this trail, and me and him sat back in camp because, you know, we wanted to give the boys a full experience. And our two furthest teams actually had the Bigfoot step out on the trail in between them. And then it come around and stood behind the boys about 20 feet behind them on the farthest team. And, of course, they were freaking out. So they called us on the radio and said, you know, coach, can y'all come down here? You know, we just seen one. So we started to go down in there, and we got to the first team, and they were sitting down basically on the creek bank where the trail come close to it. And they said, you know, we've been hearing something splashing in the water over there, and it smells like a four-week-old dead fish smell. And we got one in that area that smells like dead fish. And so I told my other researcher, I said, well, I'll stay here with them and listen while you go up and collect the other boys. Well, he went up there and sat with them for about 10 minutes, and I was sitting there, and the smell would come in, and then it'd go out, and I'd hear something splashing in the water a little bit. And, you know, if it was a dead fish laying there somewhere, the smell wouldn't just keep going in and out. It would have stayed pretty consistent. So after he sat up there for a little while with the boys, he started sending them back. And when he got down there to me, I was like, Big Head, there's that's his nickname in the group. I said, you know, I think our buddy's back. You know, I keep smelling the smell. And we stood there for a few minutes, and he would smell it too, and we'd hear something splashing. So we went up a little bit through on the creek there, and I was like, okay, well, let's shine our lights up there and see what happens. Well, just as we turned our lights on, we saw a Bigfoot step out of the creek onto the bank between this V-shaped tree. And, of course, we had four boys there with us, and they were already pretty well at the end of their bottle being filled up. And they saw it, and they were like, holy cow, you see that, you see that? And it stood behind this tree, and it kept trying to look around because we kept our lights on it. And my batteries were starting to go low on my flashlight, so we got on the walkie-talkie and we radioed back to camp and we told the boys, you know, bring everything that shines. Well, we was probably a good 300-400 feet from camp down along this trail and everything. And those boys practically made it there in about, I'd say, 10 seconds flat. I mean, they run down there with everything that they could find that would shine. So we light up the whole bank. I mean, this Bigfoot's caught between this tree, and he keeps looking out, and they can see his eyes. They see his face. I mean, they're freaking out. There's 12 of us down there all together. And we're watching this thing for a good 5 minutes, and it can't go nowhere because we've got it pinned down with lights. And if a Bigfoot can cloak, I think this would have been the most opportune time for it to cloak. But we kept it pinned behind that tree, and then I was like, you know what, guys? Let's turn our lights off for just a second, turn it back on, and see if we can catch it coming out into the open and try to get away because we wanted a better look. And so we turned the lights off, and by the time we turned it back on, there was some river reed behind that tree, about 50 feet behind it. That Bigfoot had cleared from that tree to the river reed, and all you seen was the river reed weaving back and forth where it had just made a beeline through that river reed. So that's basically what happened there. I mean, there was 12 of us watching this thing, and we watched it for a good 5 minutes.
How were you able to get so close to it?
Well, we were, we actually looked at the distance the next day when we had some daylight, and we were probably within 100, 120 feet from it.
Okay. And this went on for how many minutes, would you say?
About 5 minutes. That was the actual time we watched it. Now, it probably was there for an extra 10 minutes before we actually spotlighted it because, you know, the boys smelled the smell, and then, of course, I was smelling it. And this is one that we had seen on quite a few occasions. And basically, all my researchers, when they go into this area, they know if you start smelling a dead fish smell, and we think it's because this one Bigfoot pretty much its diet is fish, and so it's got this body odor to it. And when you start smelling a dead fish smell, yeah, you're on a creek, you know, it could be a dead fish, but it just makes you kind of heighten your awareness that it's possible it's in the area.
Wow. Do you think, were you downwind or any other factors do you think that led up to you being able to get that kind of encounter, or was it just luck?
Well, I think it was just the fact that we had so many people spaced out along that trail that the Bigfoot really didn't know which way to go. And he was kind of pinned down in the creek bed there. And when we kind of walked up towards him and shined our lights, he had kind of panicked and jumped out behind that tree. So, you know, it was just really a lot of factors. The boys had been making a lot of noise. And earlier in the day, you know, they were running all over the place, jumping in the creek, having a blast, and just doing what boys would do. And this area seems, if you got a lot of kids playing, they seem to come down to check out what the kids are doing. And But this is in one of our major research areas. This is where my researcher had his sighting last night of one. 2 weeks ago, we actually had 5 different Bigfoot coming through all at the same time. I mean, they come through as a group, but they were doing whoops as they moved through the area. And, of course, we tried to record it, but it happened like 5 o'clock in the morning, and I was fumbling with the recorder trying to get it to record, and we didn't get it, but there was about 6 of us that heard him vocalizing. So...
Were you scared when you saw it?
Actually, no, not really. You know, I've had, out of the 4,000 times I've been out in the woods, I've had 23 different encounters, you know, so it's getting to where, you know, it doesn't faze me as much as it did when I seen my first one. So...
Were you able... so that wasn't your first one. Were you able to see... You know, definitive features, hair, eyes, or anything?
Yeah. It was a...
Did you just know right away that, hey, I'm looking at a Bigfoot?
Yeah, it was pretty obvious that we was looking at a Bigfoot. I mean, it stepped out on 2 legs. And, you know, when it looked around when I looked around the tree, you could see the face, you know, pretty clear. And it's a dirty brown type color, and we've got some dirty brown and even some blonde-haired Bigfoot down in that area. We've even got a large white Bigfoot that we think is the alpha for the troop for that whole area.
Okay. I don't know if you know, there's a guy named Matt Knapp. He runs the Bigfoot Crossroads blog, but he's from Oklahoma. And I was talking with him one time, and he was kind of under the impression that there's not necessarily more Bigfoot in Oklahoma. He just said there's kind of more open areas, so people see them more. Do you think there's any truth to that?
I think we're actually seeing an increase in the Bigfoot population, because our deer population has just flat exploded. And there's also more food sources. They're able to raid more garbage. You know, I'm not saying that we're having a big implosion, but I think we're having more reproduction going on because of the food sources can actually support that many. And, of course, now we've also got more and more people moving out into the countryside where nobody lived at before. I mean, basically, somebody will go out, clear off a spot, and drop a trailer all within 48 hours, and this is where Bigfoot probably hung out at, and Bigfoot's like, you know, what the heck? How'd that happen? And those people have something slapped the side of their trailers for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, come up and slap the window air conditioners, you know, and just cause all kinds of havoc because the Bigfoot's kind of pissed off that all of a sudden this trailer got dropped off into one of its areas. And we've had a lot of reports, you know, basically supporting that theory.
Interesting. So is this considered the Big Thicket? Is that part of Oklahoma or is that Texas?
No, actually the Big Thicket is probably about mid-Texas. Pretty much everything in our area is the Kiamichi Mountains and the Wichita Mountains. So, you know, we've basically got our own, for lack of a better way of saying it, ecosystem here. So.
Okay. Interesting. Because I know we were talking last week about how in Texas, they did a show on Bigfoot, and they showed the Bigfoot sightings, which were concentrated in eastern Texas. That matched the heavy rainfall amounts, which was in eastern Texas. I wonder if that kind of correlation is true in Oklahoma as well. Heavy rainfall
we tend to have a lot of
sightings.
Well, we've got a lot down in the southeast corner of the state. where they do have a lot of swampy type areas. And it does seem like when you have more rain, it seems to drive them up out of the bottoms. So, you know, it's kind of like around here. When it rains real hard, they seem to get up out of the bottoms where all the creeks are and everything. But we do have probably just about as much percentage of rainfall as they do in Washington and Oregon.
Oh, okay.
That's quite a bit.
Someone in the chat room was wondering, have you had stones thrown at you when you've been in the field?
Oh, yeah. I've had so many thrown at me that even when I do get them thrown at me, I'm so used to it, it's like, okay, well, that was a rock being thrown, you know. But one thing that we do now is when we do have rocks thrown at us, we take our thermal and scan the ground and see if we can locate the rock that was thrown at us. And we've got protocols in place to where when we locate that stone, we treat it as a viable source for fingerprints. And we collect it as such. Nobody handles it with bare hands. We pick it up, we take it back, we'll dust it for prints. And, you know, some rocks has a texture that won't let you take prints off of it. But there's always a chance that you're going to get a smooth stone and there's a fingerprint on it where they held it.
Interesting. I think just more of these type of protocols, they are necessary in gaining evidence and moving forward with this because, you know, all we really have is small groups of independent researchers going out in the field. So it's up to the common man to prove it, huh?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, one reason why we look at fingerprints on the rocks itself is Charles Hallmark used to do a lot of research down at Chickasaw National Park. And, of course, you know, there's been some controversy about the man, but his research, we've actually got to take a look at it. And he would go and take and put in trash cans. He would take a cup, the type that you get like at Sonic that's got the wax wax coating on it, and he would put it in the bottom of a trash can with Fig Newtons in it. And on top of that, he would put a bag of real buttery popcorn. And his concept was the Bigfoot would eat some of the popcorn and reach down and pick the cup up to get the Fig Newtons out. And he would have the fingerprints. And he's got quite a few cups that actually had fingerprints that was twice the size of human fingers. And so what we do is we look at those rocks, and if we find a fingerprint that is bigger than a human hand, then, you know, can we actually say a Bigfoot threw it? No, but here is some evidence to kind of back up the fact that something with a big fingerprint threw a rock at us.
So what's the next step in a situation like that where you say the man has actually gathered the cups and there were fingerprints on them? What would your next step be?
Well, basically, you know, until we bring in a Bigfoot and actually fingerprint him and, you know, see
there's
what their fingerprints look like.
Yeah.
Basically, all it is just additional evidence that, you know, something is picking these cups up that's got twice the size fingers of a man.
Right.
So, you know, basically it just goes into our collective evidence. Eventually, when the time comes, maybe we'll be able to bring it all out and say, you know, yeah, we were getting this as far back as here. And so basically, it's collateral evidence. I mean, it just adds to the evidence pool.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah, one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, is there anything that you've experienced that that's not, you know, I think pretty much all the groups are finding have at some point found footprints, and some have been fortunate enough to find hair and have anecdotal sightings. What, I mean, is there anything unusual that, that you've experienced that, that as far as evidence, you know, that isn't commonly reported? Or?
Actually, yeah. We actually had an incident where we had several somethings. I'm not going to say it's Bigfoot, but I'm going to say several somethings crawled up to me, my wife, and the landowners in the middle of this field where there had been Bigfoot sightings, and we'd actually seen a Bigfoot down in the corner of the field with a night scope just about 20 minutes before this happened. And we were sitting there in the middle of the field, and the landowner's wife was sitting there with her smartphone playing games, and it kind of lit her up, and she started getting hit by something. And she thought it was just bugs, you know, because of the light from her phone. They were being attracted to that. Well, after about three or four times she got hit, her son jumped up and got a flashlight and went over there and was looking around to see if it was a bug. He was going to kill it so it stopped hitting her. And that's when he found what we refer to as a grass ball. It was just a bunch of grass bent around and folded up and tied off. And there's three or four of them laying there. So we picked them up and we put them on the table and we were looking at them. And we was all standing around it, and out of the field from behind some of the people that was standing there with me, another one comes sailing over them out of the field and landed right in the middle of us. And this went on for a good 40 minutes. I mean, you know, just not bam, 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 but, you know, at random it would hit us. So we were collecting this, and finally I decided it was time to walk out there and see if I could jump them and get them to stand up. I had a camera in my hand. I was like, well, if they stand up, I'm going to take a picture. Well, as I started going out into the field in the direction that they were coming from, as I was out there trying to find them, another grass ball come from the opposite side of us in. So we've actually got these grass balls collected, and thanks to Paul Vella, he helped us come up with a way to preserve them. And we actually display them every year at the symposium. But these grass balls, I haven't heard really anybody else getting grass balls thrown at us. And we think what had happened was the rocks in the area, in that field, were huge. I mean, if they would have picked them up and thrown them at us, would have killed us. So we pretty much deduced that probably juveniles had come up and was throwing these at us to see how we would react. And we actually sat there and tried to replicate these grass balls ourselves. And we couldn't do it with our fingers. Even my grandson tried to do it, and he got fairly close, but not close enough.
Interesting.
And this actually is only about 2 miles from the research area where we've seen the one step out of the creek behind the tree.
Oh, okay.
So, Darren, how many visual encounters have you had?
23.
Holy cow, yeah. So.
Yeah, but of course, you know, before somebody says, oh, you can't have that many, I've been out there 4,000 times. So, you know,
yeah,
that's really a small percentage. So.
Interesting.
Well, it takes two things to have a sighting, one, a Bigfoot, and somebody there to see it. So, the more often somebody's out in the field, the more likely, you know. If you're sitting in an armchair, you might see one on TV. But, yeah, I don't think people understand that if you have an active area, and you go to it frequently, 4,000 times is, I'd say, pretty frequently, so you're
yeah.
much like more, you're right, increasing your chances of seeing them exponentially by going outside and going to where they're at.
Well, we're reaching the top of the hour here.
Okay.
So we'll take a 4 or 5 minute break here, and then we'll be back to give away our 5-variety sample pack of Sasquatch coffee. So if you're signed into the chat room under a name, you'll be in the drawing, and we'll be doing that shortly. So we'll see you soon, and then we'll have more with D.W. Lee. All right, we're back. We're going to give away some coffee in a minute here.
And then if you want to call in, the number is 347-326-9859. And you just press 1 to talk. Or you can ask us some questions in the chat room as well. Okay, let's do it. Who wants some coffee? Some Sasquatch coffee. Have you tried it, Yeti? All right, we're going to do it here. The winner of the sample pack, 5 varieties of coffee, is Digger Dog.
Digger.
Congratulations, Digger Dog.
You want to just shoot me your mailing address or your shipping address? Private message me in the chat room, and I will get that shipped out to you tomorrow morning.
Awesome. That's cool. You got the sampler patch now. Is that something new?
We've had them for a while. They're not on the website, but we have them in the retail store. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very nice. Awesome. All right. So, DW, I was curious, Darkwing, how did you get your nickname? I know most nicknames are given. How did that happen?
I worked at a place where basically everything that was dangerous to do, they'd call on me to do it because I seemed to have a pretty good round of common sense on me. And, of course, my initials are DW. And about this time, Darkwing Duck, the cartoon, was out there. So they started calling me Darkwing, you know, because he's always saying, let's get dangerous. And the name pretty much stuck. So I've used it ever since, I believe it was 91 when I basically got the nickname. And that's how I come around with Darkwing. So.
Nice. Well, that's cool. One thing I was curious about, and it was, do you have a certain time of year where you feel there's more activity and you go out in the field more?
Well, I prefer going out in the wintertime, of course, because it's cool and you ain't got to listen to all the bugs and the frogs and stuff like that. But I seem to have just as much success during the summertime as I do the wintertime.
Okay. And do you guys have mostly deciduous trees, or you have pine as well, right?
We have a little bit of everything here.
So during the winter, obviously, you can see through the woods better.
Oh, yeah.
That's cool. So you guys have been doing work now. How big are your groups that you go out with now?
Well, I would say some of the groups range in size from just a couple of us all the way up to, you know, 10, 11 people. But I spend a lot of my time just going out by myself. So.
Does that work better for you?
Well, I would say it's about half and half. I mean, some of the times the bigger group seems to draw them in, you know, to check out what's going on. Sometimes, you know, it hampers things. So it's really just a mixed bag. A lot of times I'll just go and sit with the thermal and just let the thermal record video all night and just sit there with it and listen. And then, of course, you got to go back and review all that video, but it's, like I said, it's really just a a mixed bag. Sometimes it helps, sometimes it's a hindrance. Really just depends on how the Bigfoot feel that week, that night that we're out there, or that day.
Do you have to go very far to get to a good spot?
Actually, most of my spots are roughly about 15 minutes from the house.
How many areas do you investigate?
I have about 10 research areas within a 30-minute radius of me.
Wow,
that's awesome.
Do you think you're dealing with more than one group or several groups? Or?
Well, basically, we believe we have an overall troop that breaks down into subtroop or subgroups, and they tend to go out and seem to basically scrounge for food and everything else, you know, as smaller groups. And then every so often, we'll, like a couple of weeks ago, we had five of them come through whooping them everything. So we really truly believe for this area, we have, like I said, the overall troop, and then they break down into different little groups to go scrounge for food and scavenge and stuff like that.
I'm guessing with 10 research areas, you have little need to travel out of state, and you did say that your organization or group is pretty widespread now. Do you travel to other states or...
yeah, when I get the time, I'll go to these. Each state that we have enough members at, we have a state director who puts on, who organizes expeditions. And if I had the time, then I go and, you know, appear at the expedition, you know, maybe do some research with them. It's just, you know, when we got members across the whole United States, it's just hard to get to every expedition that we have.
Are your expeditions open to the public, or are they closed to members within the group?
Well, we do tend to open it up at times for what we call independents to come in with us and, you know, go out to our research areas. So, you know, if anybody wants to come along, just shoot me a message on Facebook, or, you know, go to the MABRC forums, and, you know, we just don't let everybody, you know, we kind of check everybody out, but, you know, it is open to the public at times.
Nice. Okay. You're lucky to have something so close.
Yeah.
I have to go about,
you know,
3 hours.
So, Darren,
in
your 10 research areas, I mean, are you able to identify individual creatures? I mean, you've been doing this a long time. By now, are you processing your audio so that you identify different? Are you able to? Because we're working on, like, doing voice prints on with our audio. So,
well, we have the white one. You know, we identified it. We also, of course, we have the one that stinks like, you know, dead fish. And we have three that's basically a family unit that goes and what they do is they're blonde hair colored. So they come in and... you know, we identified them. And then we got one that's basically black. And it does go and it has a little bit of a temperament. And then, of course, we got the juveniles, you know. Over in Skellyville, one of our research areas, we've identified that basically as a nursery. And we've watched every year as the footprints get bigger and bigger that we find. But they're still the same basic shape, so we can identify these juveniles as they're growing up. But as far as coming across and identifying specific ones by their, you know, their vocalizations and stuff, we really haven't got into it that much detail.
White one, that's cool. I suppose that would work out pretty good in winter.
Yeah. Well, he seems to pop up and...
He does
seem to pop up in all the different research areas. You know, he seems to migrate around a certain path. So, you know, that's why we think he's the alpha. I think he just kind of goes from group to group, you know, checking on them and stuff like that. So,
what kind of technology are you utilizing? You said if you were using FLIR, do you have a protocol for collecting audio and video? Or, you know, if you've seen them 23 times, it seems like eventually you'd be able to get a picture.
Yeah, I've actually we have a DVR unit set up on our thermal camera, and it also is connected to a super ear that's mounted on the camera itself. So we're continuously recording audio at the same time as we're recording the video. And as far as video, you know, I run with a video camera mounted on a hat. And sometimes, you know, it's more of a hindrance trying to carry the camera, but we do have procedures in place and stuff like that, you know. Always try to have a camera running. The audio, the night that we had five of them come through, that was my fault. I was pretty much dead to the world and was trying to get some sleep, and the batteries ran out on my recorder, and when I realized it, I tried to swap them out, and of course I missed getting the five of them on audio, but we do go into a lot of detail about how to do things, and that'll be pretty much in the book, you know, so it'll help other people come up with their own policies and procedures and stuff like that.
I suppose it's just a matter of time maybe before something good gets caught on film, because it is hard. I was out in the woods, heard some rustling, got my camera out, ran out to this marshy area, 1 foot sunk down into the bog as it was a deer, ran out, and it was like the shakiest, worst video ever of me just trying to film a deer because it happened
yeah.
So quick. And I heard the noise and I saw it, and it, you know, I got a little bit of it on video, but it was like a bobbing mess. I
yeah,
imagine at night it's a whole different story.
Pretty much at night, you pretty much just got to rely on the thermal to catch it, because when you're using night vision, they don't necessarily see the infrared light beam itself, but they do see the little red light on the end of your nightscope, you know, as you're panning around trying to locate them. But we do have pictures of a juvenile that was crossing a trail, and there was four of us there when it happened. We actually have those... I know they're on the forum. I don't know if they're posted in the MABRC Facebook page or not. But we had two adults with him, and they were standing on either side of the trail. And it was kind of funny. One researcher was looking at one of the adults on one side of it. The other researcher was looking at the other adult. And one researcher was watching the juvenile go across. And here I was just trying to take pictures, and we actually caught the juvenile as it appeared to go from one adult to the other across that trail.
So you think it's just a matter of time?
I think it's just a matter of time to really catch one right out in the open. You just got to be at the right place at the right time.
Did you have visuals pretty early? Did you find it took a while? Do you think they're kind of acclimated to you at this point? Or?
Yeah, the ones down in Skillyville, seemed to get pretty acclimated to us because I drove a Chevy Blazer that had a distinctive squeak to it. And it got to the point to where we would pull up with that Blazer in the evening, and it wouldn't take them long before they got close enough to, you know, toss a few rocks at us and do some vocalizations and break some twigs. And they even had a juvenile step out out in the open during a full moon on us. And me and my wife were sitting there, and she had dozed off. And when I seen it step out, I nudged her, and it just stood there watching us. And she woke up, and she goes, "Man, I see that little one standing there." And we looked a little bit over to the side, and two adults were standing over there in these bushes, and they were kind of weaving back and forth along with the bushes like they were part of the bush and just moving in the wind. And we kind of knew then, you know, they were just testing to see what we'd do when we seen that little one out there. If I would open the door, those two big ones would have probably come out pretty quick, so.
And have you had...
But, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So you've had them step out, but a lot of... They come into the area where do you have the same a particular area that you're going to and set up camp all the time, or...?
Basically, we stay in different spots. You know, we don't really just continue going to one spot. We like to... We don't want to wear out one spot. We kind of just rotate them.
Mm-hmm.
But we have had them. We have had what we assume is two Bigfoot calling out my grandson's name one time at one spot where we camped out a lot. And what had happened was he was about seven at the time, and there was us and about five other researchers down there. And, of course, you know, seven-year-old boy, we're having to say, you know, "Izzy, would you get over here? Izzy, would you stop that? Izzy, get out of there." You know, he was just getting into things as a boy would. And one of our researchers walked around his vehicle, and it was parked right beside River Reed, and there was a juvenile. And it had gotten really close to the camp, and that kind of spooked me. So I went ahead and took my grandson back in and left him with my sister. And we went back out, and me and my wife went to bed that night, and we're laying there in the tent, and out of nowhere you hear, "Izzy." And my wife sat up. She's like, "Did you hear that?" I was like, "Yeah." And again it went, "Izzy." And then another one said, "Izzy, too." You know, it was a different voice. And they
really?
Said it about four or five times. And so, you know, we're sitting there, and my wife is freaking out, and after it sounded like they left, she's like, "That's it, I'm getting in the vehicle," you know. So we got out and kind of walked over and started getting in the vehicle, and one of the other researchers asked us what was going on, and when we told him, he said, "Yeah, I thought I heard something." Well, last year during the symposium, Paul Holsey, I think everybody knows him as Bama Bigfooter, he was camped down there with Henry Mays, and I had hollered out a couple of times for my wife, and I'd said her name out pretty loud. Well, sometime later that next early morning, something comes sneaking up behind his tent saying, "Bobby, Bobby," that's my wife's name. And he actually got that recorded on audio. So are they so used to me that, you know, they're repeating what I'm saying? You know, we couldn't really say, but the evidence is just really wild that their names have gotten repeated, and I was the one that was saying their names that much.
Hmm. I like the idea of mixing the camping up.
Yeah.
But I heard a story.
Yeah, we may camp one time at Skillyville. Next time we might camp at the River Reed. We might go up and camp behind the landfill and, you know, the Devil's Cauldron. So, you know, it's, We got quite a few areas that we can rotate in.
Have you seen crossover in one area where you've seen the same Bigfoot in one of your research areas and then in a different research area?
Yeah, actually we have, of course, the white one, he moves through all the research areas. Basically, we pin our research areas. They're within 2 miles of a high-voltage power line right-of-way that goes all the way around through our county here and actually goes down into the next county. But it all goes, it's one continuous loop, and he's been spotted all along that loop 2 miles away at the farthest distance. So, and of course we've seen some of the juveniles used to be up in Skillyville, but now they've moved down to the River Reed area. So they do rotate their, they do, for lack of a better word, migrate around these research areas.
Yeah, I like the different spots because it's like you're doing an off pattern, which I think is kind of what they do a lot. I mean, if they've remained undetected this long, I mean, it's 2014, we got towns and roads everywhere. You know, if they've remained this long not discovered, they're doing things different a lot. I mean, they might have certain areas they frequent, but their life's got to be one random deal.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, we just
find out,
oh, okay, there's Bigfoot goes here. Well, let's just go there then, and we'll find it, you know. It's like no one can really lead someone to one, you know, at their will.
Yeah, and see, we can go out to our research areas, and we may go out 10 times and not have anything happen because we just so happen to go to a research area that they're not at. And then that 11th time, you know, basically all hell breaks loose. We got all kinds of activity, and it's just because we just happened to be in the same spot that they were.
All right, we're having a question in the chat room whether or not you would kill a Squatch.
Well, you know, that's that old stupid no-kill, pro-kill argument. You know, I will say this. I believe we need a body to actually prove it. You know, am I the one that's going to pull the trigger? I would pull it in self-defense. You know, if I'm walking through the woods and one steps right out in front of me from behind a tree and I'm armed, you know, am I going to freak out and shoot at it or, you know, am I going to take off running? I can't answer that until it actually happens, but I'm not out there actively trying to bring in a type specimen. I figure more than anything we're going to end up having a semi wipe one out on the road and, you know, they'll be our type specimen right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's surprising that we haven't found a body yet. I mean, do they bury their dead? Do they, you know, it's hard to, or is there just that few of them that, you know, when they fall in the woods, they just disappear?
Well, you know, when you really think about it, just how far back do people actually go in the woods? You know, there's areas around here that nobody's been in ever. And, of course, you know, Bigfoot being an animal just like any other animal, our bears around here will actually crawl into crevices and holes and stuff like that when they're getting ready to die or they're sick. You know, Bigfoot could do the same thing, and of course you start piling up leaves in those crevices, you'll never find the body. You know, it's as good as buried.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I didn't know that about the bears.
Yeah, all animals go and hide themselves from when they, you know, they think when they're aware that they're not healthy, protect themselves from predators. And that doesn't even account for, you know, I mean, that's an argument why we found the body and you know, how many mountain lions get found, how many bears get found, you know, and you're talking about a much smaller population and then not even factoring how much aware they are of not wanting to be found or if they bury their dead or, you know, so...
And, of course, you know, as far as getting hit by a vehicle, you know, there's a lot of deer that will actually go and after they get hit by a car will still go 2 or 3 miles before they finally collapse, you know, dead. Not all of them actually get killed right at the road. So, hang on just a second, guys. Let me get them to turn the TV down. Hey, turn that TV down. Can you go tell them to turn that TV down? Sorry about that, guys.
That's okay. So you think they're growing in numbers, huh? Even with such isolation and urban development and human expansion, huh?
Yeah, because,
seems like there'd
you know,
be more inbreeding because of the isolation, which obviously wouldn't be in their favor.
It's
in
really
long
expected
run.
Here in Oklahoma that we have a troop along every waterway or watershed. And, you know, some of these watersheds actually cross each other and, you know, connect to each other. So there's a good possibility, you know, that there's not as much inbreeding going on as everybody would think.
Follow the waterways?
Follow the waterways. I know that sounds like a legend of Boggy Creek. He always travels the creeks, but, you know, they do tend to stay close to the water sources.
Yeah, that movie was sweet. I just saw it for the first time, I don't know, not that many years ago, and that was really cool. That almost seemed like it could have been an inbred one. It had the three toes or whatever, and it was a lot of people witnessed that one, though, huh?
Yeah.
Pretty,
and of course, you know,
evidence.
There's been quite a few good books on that. On that particular animal, and I'm actually only 3 hours away from that location. So.
Oh, okay. Nice. Yeah, didn't someone just come out with a book on that?
Yeah, Lyle Blackburn.
Okay.
And I'd really highly recommend it. I mean, it's a really good written book.
Yeah, you spent a lot of time researching that. That was. He is the acknowledged expert on Boggy Creek.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've read it then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I would recommend that book, and I'd even recommend Tom Powell's The Locals book. I mean, if you really want to learn more about Bigfoot, those are two good books right there.
Okay. Very nice. Oh, looks like we have a caller. Okay, 601. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. How's it going there?
Good.
I know you keep referring to Falk and the Beast of Boggy Creek and all that. I'm loving the show. I'm doing my own thing here, but I mean, I really like how eastern Oklahoma fits in with western Arkansas and the Wakita Mountains. And I wanted to say, I'm not sure if I've talked to any of y'all yet in any capacity, but I live in Texarkana, and you're talking 15 minutes from Meccaville of South. So. Honestly, you know, I know Lyle has the best book out there. There's no doubt about it. I would suggest Smokey Crabtree's books. He's still around down there. He's very welcoming, and I would say it's not like Lyle's books. It is a lot of history of Falk and how to hunt and so forth and so on, but I would suggest his books. And gosh, if y'all ever come this way, look me up, and we'll go down to the Monster Mart and take some pictures. It's a fun place to be, I can tell you.
Nice. So who is this? Who are we speaking to?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Brian Ampey. I mean,
okay.
whatever.
Texarkana.
Yeah, Texarkana. Yeah, I've got a 601 Mississippi number. I've been here a couple of years, but I stopped changing my number over the last couple moves. That gets a little boring. But that's pretty much all I want to say. But, you know, that's my suggestion, Smokey Crabtree's book. Just, you know, there's some peripheral books, but, you know, Lyle's is the perennial book, no doubt about it. Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, good. I mean, and I'm actually trying. I may not make it to the Stillwell, Oklahoma conference, but I'm going to try.
Okay. Well, if you come up, be sure to give me a holler, and, you know, we'll definitely get you out there in the field with us when you come up.
All right, no problem. And don't forget about the Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson a couple weeks after that, and the Boggy Creek thing at the end of October. Man, October is a great month for this subject. Down here. So, all right,
nice.
Well, keep talking, y'all.
All right. Thanks for calling, Brian.
All righty. Have a good one.
You too.
Thank you.
Seems like there's quite a lot of interest down there in Texas and Oklahoma, huh?
Oh, yeah, there is. So
what do you got coming up that's in your near future for the Bigfoot world?
Well,
besides your book.
We've been talking about the Oklahoma Bigfoot Symposium will be first weekend of October there in Stillwell, Oklahoma. We're still getting a few speakers together. You know, they haven't really committed to us yet, so we haven't released us speakers. But one thing that we do is during the symposium, MABRC researchers camp out in all these research areas that we got. During that weekend, and we do take people out there with us that, you know, wants to go out there and experience this for themselves. So if anybody wants to come up to the symposium, you know, we'll take you out to our research areas. Only thing we ask is that, you know, you follow our rules, and, you know, we don't want anybody out there firing off firearms or anything like that, because the MABRC, we leave it up to our individual researchers to decide if they're pro-kill or no-kill, but they always know that we're not out there on these expeditions or excursions to shoot one. We're out there to research them. So, but we have that coming up. Of course, we have our winter expeditions coming up. We usually go out and have about 15 expeditions a year around the country. Probably have about five of those here in Oklahoma. Memorial Day weekend, we were actually over in Arkansas for that expedition. So, you know, we got a lot of expeditions coming up. We got the symposium. Of course, like you said, we got the book. Hopefully it'll be out here in just a few months. It's roughly, like I said, about 500 pages, and we'll make it available for Kindle. And if anybody really wants to learn more about the MABRC, you know, we have our MABRC forums. That's basically where we post all of our research and keep in touch with one another. We have the MABRC public page on Facebook if anybody wants to go check out some of the stuff we've got posted there. And I actually posted a little bit earlier the link to the grass ball pictures that we have on Facebook for anybody that wanted to go check out the grass balls. So,
okay.
In fact, I'll post it again. There you go. I went ahead and posted the link again for anybody that wants to go check them out. So, but overall,
throwing all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Basically, just continuing to do my research, and we've got quite a bit of thermal footage right now of of a Bigfoot coming up and checking our camp out that was taken by two different researchers 3 weeks apart at the same location. So, you know, we know basically where they're coming up at, and that's where we've been focusing our thermals at, hoping to catch them. So.
Now, do you do any trail cam stuff?
No, actually, we've got to the point to where, now we did have a location where there was an abandoned house and we were hiding the trail cams inside the house. And we actually caught a possible Bigfoot leaning over in front of the camera, but it was so close that the flash had went and whited his fur out. All you can see is the outline with fur. But basically what we use trail cams for now is basically we use them to, if we don't want Bigfoot coming in on one side of our camp, we'll put all of our trail cams on that side. And they always seem to go around those trail cams and come in from the other side. So we use it basically just to funnel them in. Yeah, pretty much we funnel them in the direction we want them to come into. So.
Nice. Wow. Exciting stuff. So definitely keeps you motivated, huh? Do you think it's going to be proven in the near future?
I think it'll eventually be proven. It's just it'll be proved probably by maybe a 12-year-old kid out hunting rabbits or squirrel, and you know the Bigfoot steps out in front of him and he empties his rifle into it. You know, that'll probably be how we finally end up proving this thing exists. But as far as the researchers out there, we talked about it earlier, how fragmented we are. I really don't think unless we can ever get our acts together and actually come together on things and work together as teams, I don't think we'll ever end up being the ones to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're out
yeah,
west, we're working on starting to work together, so. Cause I think that's a big thing about why we haven't solved this yet, is that, you know, you got 200 groups up there not really communicating. Everybody's starting from scratch, and I don't know, you know, how many people would know what to do if you know, there's a lot of evidence that I don't think is processed, because nobody knows, there's no resource, central resource for what to do with it, so.
Yeah, pretty much, if I come across a body, basically I'm going to tie it to the back of my car or to my four-wheeler and, you know, hightail it back into town and get it in front of a camera, you know, because, and I'm not trying to say conspiracy theory, I'm just saying, I want to get it out there to the public as fast as possible. So I'm not going to sit on it and say, oh, we recovered a body, but, you know, it won't be released for 6 or 7 months. And, you know, screw that. I'm going to get it out there just as fast as it happens.
Where
that
would
was
you
a good
take
way to
it?
Do things.
What now?
Where would you take it? Would you take it to a university? Would you take it to, who would you take it to?
Well, first thing I do is take it to a TV station. I've got about 4 of them within an hour drive from me. Get it on TV, that way you know it's out there. And then I would probably end up taking it to University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
Get it out there, and I mean it's going to be a heavy job.
Yeah. Well, I figure if all I end up with is a leg when I get there, at least I got a piece of it there. So.
And it's
yeah.
So odd nothing like that has happened beforehand.
Yeah. You know, there's so many conspiracy theories and ideas of what has happened.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with people have found a body, but, you know, they've got spooked off because usually there's others around, unless it's just a solitary Bigfoot out there on its own. But they get spooked off, and of course, you know, there's a lot of them that they're out there in the woods actually hunting illegally. So they're not real eager to go to the police and say, yeah, we found this out there, or, you know, the game warden, because then there's a lot of questions.
Like, yeah,
of course,
why are they
out there? Yeah, there's also, you know, the guys that actually have marijuana fields out there or meth labs, you know. Maybe they've seen these things, but they're not going to report it because they don't want the feds or the local law enforcement running around out there where they got these illegal operations at. So
that's an interesting point about, yeah, the hunters and poachers and things. And plus, if you're alone, you could see something and you don't know what to do with it. I mean, I don't know how I would drag an 800-pound Bigfoot out of the woods by myself.
Yeah, we had a gentleman that we used to research on his property all the time, and he asked, well, he asked us, well, what if I ever come across a body? And we told him, well, take your pickup and drive right over the body and just sit there in your pickup, because the others are going to be trying to come and, you know, drag it off. And he's like, you want me to sit in my truck on top of this body while these other Bigfoot are getting pissed off? It's like, yeah, and get on the cell phone and call us, and we'll be up there just as fast as possible. But, you know, it goes back to what we was talking about earlier about, you know, why hasn't a body been found? Well, we actually have several accounts, basically the Siege of Hanobi, where several other Bigfoots come out and picked up a dead body and took off with it. So, you know, here we were telling him, pull your truck over it, you know, and that way they'd have to flip your truck over to get the body. So, you know, that's the way I see it.
It's almost like they have some sort of collective thought, or they know that one can't get found or one can't get discovered, you know? Like, they know maybe that would be the end of their freedom, or it's kind of amazing if that's the case, you know, that they're able to make sure one doesn't run in front of a car, or make sure the old one doesn't stumble into town, you know?
Well, I think it all...
Do they know where their end all?
Well, it all boils down to is you think about all the hunters that they've seen out in the woods carrying these little sticks that they point at a deer and the deer falls over dead. You know, they know that, you know, humans are dangerous because, you know, they see these deer just getting shot and falling over dead. And they tend to try to stay away from us as much as possible. And, you know, every now and then you'll get one that, for lack of a better way of saying it, and I'm not known for being politically correct, but one that's mentally retarded, you know, it's got, here in Oklahoma, we have the highest concentration of mercury in our rain. And that causes a lot of our animals to have an aggressive side to them. And we have seen several Bigfoot that have an aggressive side to them. You know, you got mercury in the rain, you know, in the water. You got chemicals being put into some of our streams and lakes. You know, so it can be affected any number of ways. And so, you know, you got a Bigfoot that is basically losing his marbles, and, you know, he really doesn't care if he gets seen or not. So you get all these sightings of one that actually comes out in people's yards and look at the kids playing and then walking off. So
do you think the other ones are watching him, though, to make sure he doesn't go too far?
You know, I really think they do try to watch him, but then, you know, there's other times that they usually, you know, boot him away from the rest of them. And I think they do their own type of DNA, what's the word I'm looking for? They do their own genetic breeding, you know. If one of them's kind of on the crazy side, they tend to run them away from the females to where, you know, they don't breed. So.
Yeah, it just
yeah,
seems
I see
odd.
Yeah, Watcher said special needs, and that's pretty much, you know, what we're talking about, a Bigfoot that's got special needs.
And
that reminds me of the Boggy Creek Bigfoot, or I'm assuming it was a Bigfoot, because I watched that movie and that thing, not, you know, I guess it's based on a true story and everything, but that thing was sticking his arm through the windows and just being super creepy, and you said, do you think others were watching him? I don't think anybody was watching him, if, you know, if that was true. He seemed to be just out running on his own. He just tormenting the town. I don't know.
Well, you know,
yeah.
In that situation, it might have just been that was just a solitary Bigfoot, you know.
Right.
One had been kicked out of the group, and, you know, that might
have
been the reason
why
he was so close
to... He may not
have
necessarily been tormenting them. They may have just been taking it that way.
Well, he had the three toes, could have had some sort of genetic defect. Yeah, I wrote something, The Legend Lives On, a Falk Monster. I did a blog post on that, and something about, you know, could have been inbreeding, and,
right.
You know, maybe it had mental illness from being so isolated from other Bigfoots, or it was calling out for other Bigfoots a lot.
And, of course, you know, could have been... it had gotten bit by a poisonous snake, and even though it fought off the poison, you know, that might have had a debilitating effect on its nervous system, and, you know, so.
Yeah,
that's pretty,
I suppose it is.
Yeah. The mercury or in the environmental effects on the wildlife.
Yeah.
The Falk Monster was not a happy Bigfoot.
A lot of people witnessed it, though. Yeah, that's what I mean. According to that documentary or movie or whatever it was, if it was a true story, he was just kind of making his rounds, it seemed like. I mean, it would scare me. It would scare the crap out of me if something like that happened. And thankfully, you know, I was able to stay home for weeks after seeing the movie, so I was fine. But then the one night we went and stayed in the cabin, you know, that entire movie just flooded back in my memory, and I'm like, oh, I can't sleep. I can't sleep now, because I kept seeing that arm come through the bathroom window. And so, you know, that makes you wonder. So I was never real sure if it were more of a true story, if it were more of a, you know, a scary movie to scare you, because I've seen lots of movies like that before I became interested in Bigfoot or came into the community or anything like that. The Mothman Prophecies, I was terrified of the Mothman for, I think, 3 or 4 years after watching the movie. And then I come here and find out that there are actual, I finally get over it, and find out that there are people who say, oh, no, yeah, there is really a Mothman. And I'm like, well, I just got over that. So I guess there's no way of knowing what's true and what's not true, and, you know.
Well, let me tell you a little story that will, and it is an honest event that happened, and it will probably make you think of not going camping again. We had a location here in Oklahoma where we were putting up cameras out from the house and running it back to a DVR. We was trying to cover the whole house area because they had all this activity. And there was roughly about 12 MABRC researchers working on this. And when time come, we was all pretty well tired, and the plan was we was going to go down in this watershed area that was on the property, where there was a lot of activity happening, and we was going to camp out and just spend the night there. That way, you know, we didn't have to all drive back home. Well, One of our researchers took and hung about 20 pounds of apples behind me and my wife's tent. And, of course, we was all pretty tired, so me and my wife, we didn't stake down our tent. It was one that had bars that went over the top. And she finally got tired. She says, you know, I'm going to go in there and lay down. And she kept hearing something moving around behind the tent. Well, when I come in there, she told me, you know, I hear something moving back there. So I laid there and I listened for a little bit, and sure enough, you know, I heard something, and finally I drifted off to sleep. Well, the wind was kind of blowing the tent back and forth, you know, it's going sideways. Well, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I just happened to hear a couple of footsteps, and then the tent goes straight up. And we're talking a tent that is about 5.5 foot tall with these crossbars on top. Whatever it was, it walked up behind the tent, grabbed that crossbar, and pulled it up about 3 foot high. And the only thing that was touching the ground was my butt. My wife actually rolled over on top of me, and we was trying to put the tent down. You know, all we could think about was the wind caught it. But whatever it was, it picked us up, and she goes, "What the H?" And as soon as she said that, it dropped it, and you heard the footprints or the footsteps as it left. And she looked at me and she goes, "That's it, I'm done, I'm getting in the car." And I was like, "Yeah, I think I'm going to get in the car too," because that was a little unnerving. So we get out, we drop the tent where it's at, and we get in the vehicle, and we watch the rest of the morning to see if it come back. Well, the next morning we went over there and looked, and you could see where the grass had been tromped down where this thing had walked up behind the tent and picked it up. And, of course, you know, I can't tell you for sure it was a Bigfoot because I didn't look out and see it, but whatever it was big enough to raise a tent, a 5 foot tall tent, an additional 2 foot high. So,
with two occupants.
Yeah, with two occupants. And like I said, when it picked it up, the only thing that was touching the ground was my butt. Everything else had went up with the tent. You know, my legs was up in the air, my head was up in the air, and you know, I got to agree with my wife. That night there, my bottle kind of filled up, too, after seeing that tent go up. And so
that'll give you cause to reevaluate the being in a tent.
Well,
yeah, that would be enough. Camping's already off the list for me, and that was beforehand. So, my imagination likes to run wild without thought of Bigfoot, so...
Well, you probably wouldn't want to go out with us at all then, because here in Oklahoma, we'll actually go and sit out in chairs all night long.
That would actually be more acceptable if I could be awake and watch my surroundings fine.
Yeah. Well, I have been known to fall asleep about 3:30 in the morning and sleep till daylight, you know, and one of these days I'm going to wake up and there's going to be a Bigfoot looking right at me in the face. So.
Nice. That's awesome. So was this a spot that was pretty well in the woods, and maybe if it was a Bigfoot, it didn't want you there? It was like, get out of here?
Well, it's just right around the corner from a huge tent camping and RV area that's on the lake there. And we think that they spend a lot of time going through those campsites, you know, looking for food being left out and stuff like that. And it just so happened that, you know, it come into the camp and seen that crossbar and just decided to, you know, hey, what the heck? I'm going to try to lift this up and see what happens. You know, just out of curiosity. So.
Well, we're down to our last minute. Thanks a lot for joining us, Darkwing.
Well, thank you for having me.
And, I look forward to hearing more about your book in the future. Be sure to let us know when that's finished.
Yeah, and like I said, it'll definitely, we'll let everybody know when it comes out.
Awesome. And when is your Oklahoma event going on, your synopsis?
The symposium's going to be... Yeah. Let me bring up my calendar here real quick so I can give you the exact dates. I believe it's the 4th through 6th.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't even have my... Give me just a second here. Make sure. It's going to be the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of October.
Of October?
And on the, on the Friday night before, we're going to have a boot camp. It's pretty much like Robert Swain is going to have at the Arkansas Bigfoot Symposium or the Bigfoot Conference in September. And that'll be in Villanova, Arkansas. So.
Okay, cool.
Where can people go to check out your field research and they can get that information again? You're on Facebook?
Well, we have a Mid-America Bigfoot Research Center group page, but our forum is www.mid-americabigfoot.com, and that'll take you to our website, and there's a little link there that goes to the forum, and that's where we put everything. We have our research threads. Each researcher has their own research thread where they talk about all the things they've done, and they put their audio on there and pictures. We also have the largest collection of Bigfoot articles on the Internet. It even pretty much eclipses Bigfoot Encounters.
Awesome.
I'll be going there to check it out. So,
so.
Appreciate that.
Thanks. All right, man. Nice talking with you.
Yep, nice to
meet
you.
Okay, same here. Same here.
We'll see you in the future.
Okay.
Good night.